Well, it's good to be here and to be with you all. I've been with several of you in the Metta retreat that just finished less than a week ago. But most of you I've last seen in the last year. Some of you I've never met before. And I've been reflecting in the last few weeks, actually into last year, I've been reflecting a lot about the nature of time and the experience of time. And even early afternoon today, I went swimming. And in the locker room, I and a friend talked about the nature of time in physics. And he was telling me about a particularly influential physicist named, some of you may know, named Lee Smolin, who questions the understanding of space-time in relativity theory. So what I want to do tonight is to actually explore in a little different way than I've been exploring time. And I want to do that first by pointing to where our practice goes as we develop our practice. As we practice mindfulness, our practice, as it were, in the future, becomes more present-centered. And in fact, one of the aims of our practice, immediately, it's perhaps more means to an end, is to be more in the present moment. That's what we were exploring in the actual sitting. So the Buddha says, do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is. The future has not yet come. Looking deeply at life as it is in the very here and now, the practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. So we particularly, in a way, use the ability to be in the present moment in order to see clearly. That insight really comes from being present-centered rather than so much thinking about what's valid or true. And we know, and I'll come back to this, we know that it's not easy to be present-centered. All sorts of conditioning takes us out of the present moment, makes it hard to be present. In fact, let me invite you, as you listen to me talk, see if you can also be present-centered now. And I'll do the same. I know when I was first, about 20 years ago, starting to move into this role more as a Dharma teacher, my mentor at the time, John Travis, he gave me instructions for teaching. He said, do your preparation, and then as you teach, be in your belly, be in your heart, and let your thoughts self-organize. So that's my intention, and see what your experience is like. Thich Nhat Hanh has some lines which you may have heard, which I know them also. I think Betsy Rose put them to music. I have arrived, I am home, in the here, in the now. I am solid, I am free, in the ultimate, I dwell. So again, pointing to this intention to be able to be present. Waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours are before me. I vow to live fully in each moment and to look at all beings with the eyes of compassion. So one of the central aspects of our practice is very related to time. It's to learn better how to be more present. And this is challenging, right? You know, I know when I was first practicing, I found myself planning a large part of the time. I probably have told this story in the past, but when I was first practicing, I had just come from living in Germany for a year, and I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go back or live in the United States. So the instructions were, be with the breath in the present moment. And I would sit there and go, in, out, Germany, United States, Germany, United States, Germany, back and forth. And then after 30 minutes, I would remember, oh, the breath. So it's not easy to be in the present moment. So another instruction that we have in relationship to time is to be able to track the flow of impermanence. In fact, the insights which are made possible by being more present-centered concern three areas of experience. We're invited to be aware of impermanence so that we can notice that things change, which we know intellectually if we ask us, but we don't really know. Right? We don't know it experientially so well. And we tend to have conditioning to think that things are permanent, in large part because of language, and also to think, despite the fact of knowing better, that we're permanent. I often invite people to raise their hand if they think they will die. I never get more than 50% of the people raising their hands. But why is that? And so the practice, when we're in the present moment, just simply noticing how things change moment to moment, is a very valuable practice. One can do this for hours, for days, and it's really valuable. You know, so you can notice the impermanence in relation to sound. Just tune into sound. A sound arises. It stays for a while. It changes. Just noticing that. And then they suddenly stop. And so that's not very dramatic, is it? Why is that so insightful? What's the big deal, right? Notice something arising, staying, changing, ending. So the pointer is that we actually, again, don't know that things change. And we have to be pointed to really track impermanence. And it's just in this very, it's rather simple. We can do it with sounds. You can actually do it with simple music, listening to the wind, listening to sounds. You can do it with body sensations. These are sort of the simplest ways to work with it. Just to be aware in the present moment, like try it right now, just being aware of the different body sensations. One comes to awareness, stays, different sensations are there. Again, doesn't seem to be a very dramatic practice, right? I already knew that things were impermanent. What's the point? Right? And, but it's more that we know intellectually in some ways, but we don't know experientially. And so this practice of just staying with impermanence is another way that we relate to learning about time. Because actually, time is primarily about change and events. You think of a clock. What does a clock do? It lets us, in a way, track change. Do you know when clocks were invented? Mechanical clocks? 1300. In the West. Before that, they had all sorts of mechanisms like sundials. And there was a very interesting, I found a passage from a Roman playwright who was complaining about the excessive use of sundials where he was living. He said, everyone is so, what reminded me of these days when I go on BART, you know, I don't know if you have this experience, but I go on BART and 90% of the people are just looking at their devices, right? It's a little bit startling. It's like a new form of human being. This Roman guy was complaining in 200. He said, all around me, people are transfixed by the sundials. It is so oppressive. Right? Everyone is bound to it. There's no freedom. People don't know how to actually look at their experience. My sundial that lets me know what time it is my belly. It tells me when I need to eat. Now people look at sundials and they go hungry. So we learn how to be in the present moment, our practice. We can track impermanence. Again, one of the three areas of insight is noticing impermanence. The other two are noticing dukkha, or when I like to translate it, as reactivity, and then noticing not self, or the nature of the self. And they all go together in terms of our practice, because it's basically the teaching is be with the impermanent flow of experience and notice where you grab hold of that flow of experience or push it away. And notice how that when you do that, there is dukkha or reactivity or suffering. And it's said, some of you know, the famous passage, Anicca Vatasankara Upatava Yadamino Upakitava Nirochanti Desang Upasamo Sukho. All things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. To be in harmony with this truth brings great happiness. The great Tibetan teacher Milarepa said, if you cannot take the fact of impermanence personally, you will not be a good practitioner. And then there's a third way that the practice points to a way of being, we might say, in relation to time. First is being present, the second is tracking impermanence. And the third is opening to what we might call a kind of timeless awareness. The Buddha talks about the deathless, that it's possible to open to this. This is really the nature of Nibbana or Nirvana. This is for the Buddha, it's the sacred. And there's a kind of awareness that goes beyond any sense of time, even any sense of impermanence. The Thai teacher Achan Mahabua said, although all phenomena without exception fall under the law of impermanence, dukkha, and anatta, the true nature of the mind doesn't fall under these laws. So he said there's a kind of an awareness which goes beyond the usual laws of experience. Or the natural power of the mind itself is that it knows and does not die. So he's saying this is the deathless. This deathlessness is something that lies beyond disintegration. This non-disintegration is something which lies beyond impermanence, dukkha, and anatta, and the common laws of nature, but we are not aware of it because conventional realities become involved with the mind and surround it. So there's some sense of opening to a kind of timeless awareness, which is pointed to by the Buddha at times, so to speak, by Thai forest tradition. Other traditions point to this, probably most prominently Tibetan traditions of Mahamudra and Dzogchen really point to something like a timeless awareness, which is accessible, which occurs when the thinking process is really not operative. And it can be accessed through the heart, through the wisdom qualities. And so our practice aims to experience these things increasingly in the future and increasingly in the present moment. But there's a nice irony that we practice now so we can be timeless in the future. Or we practice now so we can be more in the present moment in the future. This is okay. I think when we encounter paradox, where it's a sign that we're something special is happening. But isn't that interesting? There's another way to say it is that our practice has both a linear time-related dimension and a non-linear timeless dimension. And this it's also, I think, of other traditions, because there's something when we are in the present moment and more in a timeless place, there's also something that has a relationship to how we were as children. Right? That, you know, we can think of that phrase, you must become like little children to enter the kingdom of God. Right? There's something, and I was listening to a program this morning, maybe some of you heard it on the program On Being. Maybe did anyone hear that this morning? Very nice, you know. There's a Krista Tippett, right? You know that program? It's on, what, KALW at 7 a.m. Sunday mornings. I was not paid to announce that. And she had on Alison Gopnik, who teaches at Berkeley, who researches the lives of children. And there's something, you know, children have to learn how to be in time. Right, and developmentally, children only have something like our sense, our adult sense of time, at 8 or 9 years old. Earlier, they gradually take on aspects of time, but they, in many ways, live timelessly in the present moment, especially when they're younger. Right. And we can remember that, maybe even have memories of that. But to be able, for example, to have a sense this occurred 2 years ago, that doesn't occur until they're 8 or 9 years old. Right? They have some sense of past and future develops earlier, but not a fully developed sense. And so what psychologists tend to say is that the sense of time we have is constructed. Even though we tend to think that time is of the nature of objective reality, our sense of time is very much constructed. And we don't have to live with our usual conditioning around time. And this is also somewhat of a sense that you have in philosophy and physics. In philosophy, some of you know, the philosopher Kant once said that time and space are not of the nature of objective reality, but he says that they are the nature of how humans have to experience things to have any coherence. And so, almost as part of our mechanism, we project time and space onto reality. And then it was very interesting to learn more about how time is in physics. And again, there are different views. There are different views, but the basic view is that time is basically a product of the Big Bang. Was there time before the Big Bang? Apparently not. But that time is only there because the Big Bang happened, the expansion after the Big Bang was enough so that things moved into motion. If the expansion after the Big Bang was a little bit slower, everything would have congealed into like two elements, and there'd be no life, and there'd be no history after the Big Bang. It's interesting, right? So that the Big Bang is related to why we have time. The fact that it expanded at a fast enough rate. I don't know if this is that's helpful for your practice. I was also very interested, especially in our patterns of time and of how we are conditioned about time and how we work with time. What makes it hard for us to be in the present moment? What makes it hard for us to really know impermanence carefully? What makes it hard for us to access the timeless? Because I think part of our practice is to intend to be in the present moment, track impermanence, open to the timeless. Those are really the core elements of our practice in relationship to time. But a big part of it is also seeing what makes all three of those hard. And so you can reflect, what makes being in the present moment hard? We have all sorts of patterns. I was reflecting on some of them. I could reflect on my own experience, like the fact that we may be very oriented towards the future. I was mentioning my own tendency to plan and just being in the future an awful lot. That makes it harder to be in the present moment. Having a sense, I think I was really raised to have a sense that if I really planned enough, I would have security. Very common, right? And so when I look carefully at my experience, and this took like 10 years of practice, I found that I was actually scared of the present moment. And I wanted to control the future to find security. And that without that control, I was afraid. But it was beneath the level of awareness. And it took practice to really make that clearer. And I had to be, I did. It was probably after my, 10th or 15th retreat. And then I just was there sitting. I was very much in the present moment, and I noticed fear. I don't want to be in the present moment. It's scary. And better to plan. That's where I have security. And this came, this is deep in the culture. It was very much with my family. And I often joke that, my sister, who's a meditator, has a master's degree in planning. And planning is big in our family. you know, there are obvious virtues connected with it, but there's also a way that it makes it hard to be in the present moment. You know, that we have patterns where we get very, drawn to the future. Sometimes we're very drawn to the past, sometimes out of regret. Of course, if we've had difficult developmental things happen, we can be driven by the past. Traumas like that. If we have any trauma, the past trauma will hijack our ability to be in the present moment. So a lot of things make it hard to be in the present moment. Past pain that's unresolved will cause us to project onto the future, project onto the present moment in the future. And we all do this a lot, right? And so partly what we see in practice is how we do this. How do I project onto the present moment so that I'm not really with the present moment? How am I afraid of the present moment? How am I caught in the future? How am I caught in the past? You know, another pattern I was reflecting on was how sometimes we try to stop time. You know, I think particularly in terms of aging. You know, and we can do this by altering our appearance so it appears that we're not aging as much as we are. I won't ask for a show of hands. Right? But we in many ways don't like to age. Of course, when we're younger, we want to age more, right? So we do things which will make us look older. Like I know when I was a teenager, I thought smoking cigarettes would make me look older. And I remember when I was in my early 30s, and I was teaching. I remember I taught 4 years at the University of Kentucky, and I think I looked somewhat young. And people were always thinking I was a student. And sometimes I would have the first class, I would play a trick. I would sit at the back of the class, on the first class, as if I was a student, and then I would get up and walk to the front and start talking. But I ultimately solved the problem of being seen as younger than I actually was, and thus having less authority, by growing a beard. That did it. That took care of things. Right, so we may want to stop time or make the appearances different. We may try to control the future. One interesting thing is the way that we sometimes need to fill time up. That we're nervous about unfilled time. Anyone think of these experiences like that? You know, they can occur, you know, at different times. They can occur on vacations, right? We don't have planned time and we may get nervous. We may want to fill it up, or it may occur on an open day. What should I do? And often have the sense that time has to be filled up and I have to be productive. You know, you don't find that in all societies, right? So I think what I'm encouraging is, let's look. I wish we were meeting next week, but we're not. We're meeting, and I come again like in 4 weeks, so I don't know if I want you to look at your... I want us all to look at our patterns of being with time. Can you hold that for 4 weeks?
Sure.
Okay. Is that too long? A time? Okay. But we'll need reminders. But I'm going to encourage that. And so, you know, and again, people report this a lot when they retire, that all of a sudden the sense of time radically shifts. And what gave meaning, being productive and having time filled, isn't there in the same way. And it can lead to anxiety or, you know, loss of identity. That the way we use time is so connected with who we think we are. Right? So these are some of the patterns I'm inviting us to look at. We also like to control the past by controlling the narratives or the stories. This is obvious on a social level. You know, that it's said that the rulers like to control the past about what happened. I think we're seeing this in part in the impeachment trial, right? An attempt to who has the narrative about the past that wins. Right? So interesting. And there's a whole way that actually cutting through certain narratives about the past can be very important part of our own personal development. It can be very important in society, right? There are many ways that the narratives about this country, for example, still are very much controlled, and we don't see accurately a lot of what happened. Particularly, you know, we think in terms of near genocide of native people and slavery. We still don't know very well what happened. Right? That's because people in power dictate what the narrative is. Right? So maybe that's enough to talk about the patterns, but I think what's really crucial in terms of practice, and this is what I'm going to be encouraging for the next period of time, are four forms of practice. This is a way to practice with time, exploring the nature of time, having a good time, and opening beyond time. My father was a punster, so I have to be careful here. Anyway, so here are four forms of practice. That's what I'm going to suggest. The first is really tracking our habits and patterns related to time. I mentioned maybe six or eight different patterns, right? How do I control time? Am I more in the future, the past? Where am I? What are some of my patterns? How easy is it to stay in the present moment? What gets in the way of being in the present moment? Really seeing very personally what the patterns are. That's the first form of practice, okay? And it's really interesting, you know? And it can be a little bit sobering. Like when I saw, oh my God, I'm kind of afraid of the future and I'm trying to control each moment so I don't experience the present moment directly. Whoa, that's a lot, right? That's a lot. And it's probably very prevalent in the whole culture, right? I was just finding it for myself. So seeing practice number one, seeing the patterns. Practice number two, having the intention a lot to be in the present moment, both in meditation and outside of meditation. What that means is just experiencing what's going on in the present moment. So this is the core of our mindfulness practice, right? It's the center of it. But to have that intention and to live more from the present moment, that's the second directive of practice. And of course, they're related because we then see what makes that hard. So doing that more and more, again, both in meditation and out of meditation. The third is to explore impermanence. And this is a wonderful practice, very simple. It's to, and this what one can do in one's meditation. I said the simplest ways to do it are to stay with one sense, like sound or body sensations. Those are the easiest. Could also be if you're eating, smell or taste. Stay with one sense and just watch how change continually occurs. Because again, the essence of time is change. That's why we have clocks, to measure change. And that's what I remember. I looked up some, this physicist Lee Smolin, and he said that he disagreed with Einstein, which I don't know if that's a great idea, but that's what he did. He disagrees with Einstein. Einstein said that there's space-time. And this physicist Smolin, who teaches at Princeton, he said time is more fundamental than space. Time is the core nature of reality, because reality is about change and things happening. And that's the essence of time, is that something changes. So we can actually look into impermanence in these very simple ways, especially staying with one sense. Just stay with sound for 10 minutes and track something arising, staying for a while, passing away, something else arising. Can do it with the senses, can do it with taste or smell. If your mind's quiet, you can do it with thinking, just noticing one thought after another coming. And then if your mind's pretty stable, you can do it with just being aware of whatever is predominant in experience and noticing that arise, stay for a while, pass away. A thought, body sensation, a sound, and just stay with that. So that's a third area of practice. And then the fourth is a little harder, but this is seeing if we can access this timeless awareness. A kind of awareness, and it can only really occur when the conceptual mind is quiet. So sometimes it can happen when there's a sudden shock, like if I just in the moment right after that, this is what the Tibetans do. They're doing that all the time, just to access timeless awareness. So you can clap your hands together and shock yourself, and then just notice the awareness right after the clap. I studied once with a Tibetan teacher named Mingyur Rinpoche. He gave 10 ways of accessing timeless awareness. One of them is kind of getting a little bit shocked. Another one is watching your mind when you're really exhausted and thinking is not possible. He also suggested looking at what your awareness is like after you yawn. And you could deliberately yawn. Okay. This has not entered into the mainstream of Buddhist practice in the West. But we could just all yawn and notice your awareness right after you yawn. Okay, so those are three of the 10 methods. Okay. And maybe next time I come, I'll actually can work with some of those methods, because it opens up a whole other area of practice. So those are four ways of practicing. And let me see where my notes were. Anyways, I want to end with a quotation and then open things up. Let's see. Here it is. This is a version of staying in the present moment. This is the famous passage in which the Buddha instructs Bahiya. Bahiya was a wandering yogi who asked for instructions, and the Buddha gave him instructions. He asked three times. The Buddha was involved with something, but in India, if you ask three times, you always get your wish. You always get the answer. So here are the core instructions. Here, Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what's cognized, as thought. In this way, you should train yourself. When for you in the seen is merely what is seen, in the thought is merely what is thought, then you will not be with that. When, Bahiya, you are not, quote unquote, with that, then you will not be in that. When you are not in that, then you will be neither here, nor beyond, nor in between. Just this is the end of suffering. is basically saying being in the present moment just with what one is experiencing is the way to freedom. Of course, there's a lot more, but that's the core. Any reflections, questions about the experience of time, practicing with time, having a good time with time? Okay. That was quick. A lot of hands.
I'll say something. I don't remember.
We should wait for the microphone.
I can speak.
You can. You can be next. Okay. Okay. One person has. Is that okay? You'll be.
Sure.
We'll be next.
So, well, I'm curious. A couple of years ago, a teacher made me aware of the practice of planning, basically.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking a lot about it. Apart from our study of Buddhism, are you aware of any child psychologists who, because I do think it is, as you alluded, rooted in trauma, and it is a
planning
that it is a safety, and when it's chronic, that it is a safety and security mechanism.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you were aware of any child psychologists like Alice Miller or others that have ever discussed this.
Yeah. Certainly, those who write about trauma are very clear about that. That essentially, you know, in trauma, it's very clear that essentially unprocessed trauma, not fully processed trauma, hijacks the nervous system. And when the stimulus is there, one goes into the past, into a reaction as if the past stimulus for the trauma is still there. So that's the mechanism with trauma. Yeah, I think obviously planning is very, very helpful in many ways, but you're talking about when it becomes excessive. And does that, I don't know any psychologists, maybe someone here does, who have talked about how excessive planning comes out of some degree of fear, perhaps related with past pain. It would make sense, but I think it also could be, I think mine, I don't know if mine, you know, my own conditioning came out of past pain, but not that I'm aware of directly, but it, you know, it can be passed on by the family or by the culture, you know, and there can be like a kind of general concern or fear that can be maybe more than it need be.
Yeah, it becomes ingrained.
So, but I think that's interesting. That could be a part of our practice to really investigate how we plan. When you do planning, like go into the body, see what's there. Notice that there's fear. So can we go over to, we'll get the microphone over here.
Now this will be very brief.
We'll wait to the mic. Yeah. Okay.
I heard or read, I don't remember where I heard it, where I read it, it was quite a few years ago, that time exists to keep everything from happening at once.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the physics that I read suggests that time only happened because of the Big Bang, which in a sense was everything at once. Okay, I'm on the edge of my expertise, so be careful. I think the other way of saying that is that time is inherently about change. And change not all happening to have change, one needs time. that you can't have change if everything's all there at once. So, thank you.
Now is the closest approximation to eternity that there is. And in timelessness I rest while time goes by without its touch upon me. I read that.
Oh, I thought that was yours. Yeah, yeah, that... can you say that one more time?
Now is the closest approximation to eternity that there is. In timelessness we rest while time goes by without its touch upon us.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And we have a lot of hands. Let's go this side and then over here.
Thank you. This is really wonderful. Morgan Freeman had a series on television. I'm just remembering looking at one of the episodes was on time. And I remember being struck by a British physicist whose view of time was, as I recall, that every slice of time always is present. What happens is we move through them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we experience each slice of time, but it doesn't go away just because we move through it.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is a very interesting way of playing with it. There's also the cultures, as I think you maybe even talked about this at one point, that revert. We tend to think of time past as behind us and
mm-hmm.
time future as in front of us, and there are cultures that reverse that. The logic being that we can only see what has been past.
Mm-hmm.
So past is before us, so we can see it. Future we can't see, so it's behind us.
Well,
that also helps. So the intriguing thing that I was just playing with as you were talking, be interested in your thoughts about this, is the inherent paradox in having an intention to be in the present moment.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was saying that paradox can be a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, paradox is different from a logical contradiction. Right, and paradox often suggests that we're near the limits of language, or we're at the boundaries where language doesn't fully work. And so, yeah, having the intention to be in the present moment is part of our practice, and it's that way that we... that practice has both what I was calling a linear and a non-linear dimension. That it's linear in the sense that we aim to develop in time towards the timeless, right? And that's, again, has aspects of paradox, but that's completely how it works, right? That we develop in time, that's part of our practice. And yet the main vehicle for developing in time is to be out of time. So that sounds playful. Okay, you've been patient on this side, thank you.
I find this really interesting because I think about time off and on. But as you said, we can't talk about change without talking about time,
yeah.
Because change happens in time. And but another aspect is one could say, well, time is the fourth dimension. There's three dimensions, and the
yeah.
fourth dimension is time.
Yeah.
But then I have studied things where it says, well, there's a dimension beyond, the, there's the fifth dimension,
yeah.
which is, and if you're in the fifth dimension, time doesn't exist in the same way. You could, everything exists simultaneously
yeah.
in the fifth dimension.
Yeah.
But what bothers me is that all these things are based on our perceptions. In other words, we see change through our senses.
Yeah.
Or in our mind. And we're this little creature in this vast, vast, vast universe that our abilities are pretty limited. I mean, we have instruments that measure things that our senses can't readily do. I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just, I'm randomly telling you.
We've got time.
What? I'm taking up time. If it exists. Anyway, it's just.
Thank you.
It's a time is a mystery because.
Yeah.
Our perceptions say this moment was different than the last moment, and therefore there was change, and that happened in time. But if we didn't have those perceptions, would we need time?
Yeah, let me respond briefly. I think the aspect of mystery is helpful to reflect on. It is mysterious, and you know, I hope the talk and discussion really encourages us to look at how we are conditioned about time, how we construct time, because again, the point is then to open up towards the present moment, more towards the timeless. The Tibetans say that there are four dimensions of time: past, present, future, and the timeless. It's interesting, right? And it's also the case that when one moves into this more timeless realm, like when the Buddha talks about that, he seems to have access to different parts of time, both past and future, right? And I think, you know, one of the things that in relativity theory, time travel is quite easy. It's not very hard to travel in time. It's much easier to travel towards the future than the past, although getting back can be a problem. But time travel is not hard if you can approach the speed of light.
That's the hard part.
Now that will... I'll bring that in 4 weeks from now. So, but in any case, the main thing is, I'm encouraging, is really see one's patterns, because that's that, and that can open up. But there was a sense that, and I have some friends who have very deep meditation practices who seem able to access the past in an unusual way. That again, you see that in the Buddhist text. From time to time, and it's quite stunning. That seems to go beyond conventional sense of time. Maybe last one.
On some retreats, I've had a very strong sense of the relationship between desire and time.
Yeah.
And that desire, in a sense, creates a future. Without desire, I would not be in time.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah. 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 That's. That's very interesting. That you're saying, like, wanting something implies the future, which in itself creates time, and that if we didn't want anything, we might not have time. I think we probably also it would go the other way. We could not want something, and that could also set up.
Pushing away would be the same.
That would also set up the future. You know, that not wanting something to occur would set up the future. So basically, we're saying, you know, in my language, I call these the two forms of reactivity: compulsively wanting, compulsively pushing away. So we're saying reactivity constructs time, and that without reactivity, there is no time.
Just now.
Huh?
I say just now.
Yeah. Yeah, which is...
Well, that's what she was saying in her quote.
Yeah, which I think coheres with the core teaching. Why don't we take that as something to look into? Is that the case? Because what was being pointed to, like with the quote I read from Bahia, or the core way, place I was going with the talk, is that when one can be fully in the present moment, this can open up to a sense of timelessness, because there's not thinking about past or future, and there's not a projecting onto the future, right? And so there is non-reactivity and presence, right? So that sounds very plausible. So let's look into that. Okay. Great. So we'll come back in a moment with guidance for those interested for the next 4 weeks. Hopefully, that's not too much time to look into time. Okay. So we have the.